Morning, Mr. Wallace.
Good morning, Justice Holland. May it please the Court, Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellant in this matter of the State of Delaware. In 2007, Wilmer Jenkins was convicted of rape in the second degree. That rape is known to this Court and in fact known to this panel, as this was the panel that upheld his conviction on direct appeal. During that time, what was abundantly clear is that he wanted to raise an issue of consent. He wanted to do so from the time he first spoke to the police, and he did. And he wanted to do so during his trial. After his conviction was affirmed, he, with new counsel, raised several arguments in a Rule 61 petition, one of which was that the statement that he originally gave to the police on the day that he left the hospital voluntarily, went to the police station voluntarily, and spoke to the police voluntarily, was somehow infected with a Miranda violation. The Superior Court found that there was, in fact, a Miranda violation. But the state suggests respectfully that there are a couple of problems with that finding. First and foremost, it was raised as an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to move to suppress under Miranda. The underlying problem, first of all, is the state suggests there was no Miranda violation, and certainly that there isn't a sufficient record in the Superior Court to find that, and that that, therefore, was an abuse of discretion in this particular case.
Well, and let me stop you right there. Isn't it established beyond dispute that the full Miranda warnings were not given?
Yes. The state does not dispute that, in fact, one of the warnings was missed, and that was...
Okay. And am I correct that you're not suggesting that it was close enough for government work, that the Miranda warnings that were given, even though incomplete, were sufficient?
No.
Okay, fine.
That's not...
Okay. So we start out with an undisputed failure to give adequate Miranda warnings. And the only way out of that problem would be that Miranda warnings were not required in the first place.
Exactly.
And that's
yes.
The state's position,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that Miranda warnings were not required.
So although this person was in an interrogation room in the police building, being interrogated by a police officer, and at the time that person was a suspect, was he not?
He was.
You're saying that he wasn't in custody because he drove there himself?
Yes. And in fact, there is case law out of this court and out of the United States Supreme Court that say precisely that. The problem is that there was not, in a somewhat unusual circumstance, because you're in the Rule 61 situation, there wasn't a full hearing on the Miranda issue, because there normally those questions would be raised and there would be a full factual record. Here, the factual record is dubious at best, mainly because we have the testimony of the police officer at the trial, which said, I asked him to come back voluntarily. He drove his own car. He wasn't restrained in any way. He came in. He voluntarily wanted to speak. And in fact, we know that he wanted to give his story because later on his attorney said, he wanted me to put forward the consent defense.
The way I read the state's brief, it makes the argument you're articulating now, and there wasn't a Miranda violation because he wasn't in custody. And that's clear on the record. But the alternative argument that's also made at the end of the state's brief is, if it's not clear that he was not in custody, there should be a remand to the Superior Court to address that issue.
Yes. Our suggestion is that it is clear on the record.
I understand that. That's your first argument.
Yes.
But in your brief, you do say, alternatively, it should be remanded for a hearing on the issue.
Yes. And we believe that if this court does not believe that that's clear enough as to whether custody was, in fact, whether there was custody, that would be the appropriate remedy. Because it is a factual-driven question, and there are competing sides to this. Counsel, and that gets us into the overlying all of this, is whether or not counsel was ineffective. in not attacking the statement, because counsel had a couple of things going through his head at the time. First, I don't believe there's custody. He said that clearly in his affidavit. I knew what the facts were. I didn't believe that there was clearly question of custody. Secondly, even if I raised Miranda, even if for some reason, you know, lightning struck and I was able to get it, counsel was able to get it suppressed, my client was still going to take the stand, and it was still coming in. And in fact, my client told me, and this is, I believe, paragraph 5 of Mr. Liguori's affidavit, my client wanted me to highlight. I told the police that day it was consensual.
So if we go just on that point, in Harris versus New York, the United States Supreme Court said even if your statement is excluded under Miranda, it can be used for impeachment if you testify inconsistently and your statement's otherwise voluntary.
Yes.
So in this case, the state would have relied on Harris versus New York even if there had been a finding of a Miranda violation if the testimony wasn't completely consistent.
Exactly. And because he told basically two different stories in the tape statement, and he testified at trial to the second of those, the chances that it was not going to be used as a prior inconsistent statement, that it was not going to come in, were absolutely nil. And that's where we get to the problem, I suggest, respectfully, in the second part of the analysis that the Superior Court undertook here, and that is a prejudice finding. Really, the court said there was another strategy to take, never really getting to what the key of prejudice is, and that is there a fair probability of a different outcome? One, that either the statement wasn't coming in, or two, that the outcome of the trial itself would be different. This was extremely strong physical evidence, and there was only one way for Mr. Jenkins to get his defense before. The question is, did his granddaughter consent to a sexual act with him or not? And the only way to do that, when there are two people there, is for him to give his statement. Mr. Liguori also knew that. So his performance could hardly be called deficient when he looks at the statement and he knows, I don't even believe there's custody there. When he looks at what his client is saying, that it is consensual, and he knows there's only one way to get it in. And when he also knows, my client wants me to highlight part of that statement. He wants me to highlight the fact that I told the police it was consensual at the time. Well, how can that hardly be deficient
performance? Let me interrupt here, because let's run through a slightly different scenario in terms of how the trial might have gone. Let's assume that the statement is out because of the Miranda problem, and the victim gives her testimony, and there's also the medical evidence and the DNA and all that. So there's no question but that there was sexual activity between the victim and the defendant. However, as I recall, there was some testimony from the victim about how, A, she might be losing a place to live, and B, that her grandfather had been doing this to her for a while, or had been bothering her, messing with her, whatever, you know, it may not have been specifically this act. And that seems to raise a question as to, well, what happened this day that you're starting to call it a rape and making it into a crime when apparently this has been going on for a while and you've been at least tolerating it, if not thrilled about it. And wouldn't that, assuming he doesn't testify, wouldn't that scenario at least leave a possibility that a jury would say, yeah, there was some sexual relationship there, but I can't be satisfied that this was non-consensual?
I think we have to look at two things, Your Honor. We have to put ourselves back at the time of the trial, and that is remembering that there is a rape charge and an incest charge. At the time, everyone believed, until the pre-sentence investigation when Mr. Jenkins first raised, oh, by the way, it's not my blood relative. That's not really my granddaughter. At the time, he couldn't raise, trying to raise that defense was unhelpful to him because you can't consent to incest. I mean, consent is not a defense there. And secondly, again, I'd suggest respectfully that that does exactly what the trial judge did here, and it misses the boat on the prejudice prong, and that is not that there may be some other strategy, and there's some hypothetical possibility. In fact, the cases, Strickland down to its progeny, and this court's adoption of Strickland standard says it's not some hypothetical possibility that the outcome would have been different. It's a fair probability. And given the fact that this young woman testified, the facts as it occurred, the act occurs, she is on the phone with her mother upset within minutes. The police, she's on the phone with the police within 5 minutes. She is taken to the hospital. She tells the nurse practitioner what happened to her, the nurse examiner what happened to her. The nurse finds collects the physical evidence. We collect the physical evidence from Mr. Jenkins. There are physical signs of force regarding the finding in the gums. How could a defense that simply said, you have to question whether or not there is consent, without Mr. Jenkins' testimony, possibly could have tipped that scale to the fair probability that his outcome would have been different? And the state suggests that really part of the problem with the decision in the Superior Court here is that many times the Superior Court judge sets up the proper framework but then doesn't carry through in the analysis of the facts in this case to that framework, first in the deficient performance. Because when he discusses deficient performance, all he says is, well, this wasn't a strategy decision. It wasn't a tactical decision. No, what it was, you don't have to say the magic words, tactic or strategy. What you have to say is informed. It has to be a decision.
Did I understand you to say that the case went to trial as if the victim was a blood relative?
Yes. My understanding is, reading through the entire trial and Mr. Liguori's affidavit later, it was tried as if she was a blood relative. In fact, Jenkins got the benefit of an incest instruction, a lesser-included instruction of incest also of the rape,
he might have gotten that benefit, but, you know, going back to Justice Berger's question about the statement not being in, if she goes from a blood relative to basically a close family friend, that would give the defense a whole different approach, wouldn't it? If you take it out of the equation that she's really his blood relative.
I suggest, given the dynamics of this relationship, probably not everybody. He referred to his granddaughter. Everybody referred to her as granddaughter. It was only when...
No, but my question is, if you say this is a close family friend who he treated like a granddaughter, that's different than saying this was his granddaughter.
As far as... Perhaps that would lay in some assistance to his consent defense?
Maybe.
Perhaps. Perhaps. But, again, I think we need to look at what was occurring at that trial. And, again, getting back to Justice Berger's question that Your Honor was asking about, would taking that statement out and trying to do a consent defense without Jenkins' testimony so that the statement never gets in, looking at those two circumstances, can we then say he was prejudiced by the statement came in because under that factual scenario, there's a fair probability that the outcome would have been changed? And the state suggests absolutely not. That there are so many hypotheticals placed in there and that it is so remote that it doesn't meet that Strickland standard. And that Strickland standard has been discussed by this court much more than I need to mention. It just doesn't get to fair probability at all.
Well, I was reviewing the Superior Court's decision. The only reference it seems to make to consent in the facts at the end is her allegation that she resisted and there was a struggle, and the Superior Court says evidence at the crime scene didn't show any disruption of furniture or stuff like that.
We could differ, and I think the state does differ with the Superior Court's finding that you need some, quote, greater violence or struggle. while it is true there was no disruption of furniture and things, the victim never said there was a struggle such that, you know, furniture is thrown about and things like that. She said she struggled, meaning she pulled her head away and things
that. No, I'm just trying to put the state's argument in context. And I think the state's strong point is if he didn't testify and say there was consent, there wasn't a lot that was going to support consent. The two things we focused on are, one, if it was an ongoing relationship, why did she report it for the first time? And second, that there was no overturned furniture. But in the absence of him testifying, if he's trying to make a consent argument, he's pointing to possibly a continuing relationship and the absence of any disruption in the house. Anything else he could have relied on to support consent?
Not that the state was aware of, certainly not at that point, and nothing that the state can come to now.
So your point is, if that's going to be his defense, then what happened here really was not prejudicial.
Correct. Exactly.
All right. You have about 4 minutes. Do you want to save that?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Gill.
Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, Ed Gill for Wilmer Jenkins. In this case, the trial judge was able to obviously listen to all the witnesses, decide the closeness of the case, received a motion for post-conviction relief, reviewed the record further, and found after that review of the record, after giving both sides full and fair opportunity to go ahead and comment and make their arguments in the superior court, that the failure of defense counsel to even find, much less file a suppression motion based upon the clear Miranda violation, constituted ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, let's start where I left off with Mr. Wallace on prejudice.
Yes.
Putting aside the evidence you would introduce to support it, isn't the defendant's best, if not only defense in this case, consent, given the overwhelming physical evidence, because the act occurred?
Yes.
All right. So if we're talking about how are you going to establish consent, one way is to testify. The defendant wants us to take his testimony out of the equation, and based on whatever you're now going to tell me about, how does he marshal a consent defense without testifying?
First, the burden of proof, and I don't want this to be forgotten at any point, although it's obviously basic law, the burden of proof is on the government to prove lack of consent, not for the defendant to go ahead and prove consent, to prove a lack of consent, which is obviously an element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right, and what Mr. Wallace says is, we're going to introduce the emergency room record that shows that the nature of this sexual act was violent, evidenced by injuries to the mouth and what we see on the gums.
And respectfully, that's not true.
That's what the emergency record showed?
That's correct. There is no competent evidence in this case of a lack of consent other than the complaining witness's testimony that there was, that she said no and that he continue to go ahead and force her.
Well, what we've said many times that sworn testimony is sufficient to support a lot of things at trial, including in getting you an instruction on lesser included offenses. So the real question is, if that's what she says unequivocally, this was a violent encounter, then that's enough evidence to get to the jury. And the question is, does the jury believe her or not? Why doesn't the state carry its burden simply with her testimony?
Well, because there have been a number of other factors, but respectfully, my answer to that last question, I didn't want to shortchange what the prosecution was arguing here today. I think my last answer was somewhat incomplete. What I believe that the government attorney was referring to here today is that there was a sane forensic expert, Terry Peirce, Nurse Peirce is her name, who testified in this case, and she actually testified without any objection whatsoever that what she saw, what she believed was a bruise inside the mouth of the complaining witness, and she said that that could have come from pressure continuous pressure, I think was her terminology, from the outside of the mouth. This was an oral sex case.
All right, well, let's go back to my question. I'm taking you off on a little tangent. My question is, in the absence of him testifying, what was the defense going to be? Your first answer is that the state has the burden of showing absence of consent, and that even if the victim testified that it was not consensual, you could make a strong argument she wasn't credible. So that's the first point. You'd argue burden of proof, but to the extent you didn't succeed on burden of proof, you'd argue credibility. What else would the defendant do to support consent?
Credibility obviously wouldn't simply be in a vacuum either. It would be inconsistencies in her testimony. The prior relationship, which sexual relationship, which had been ongoing between the complaining witness and the defendant in this case. No, in every rape case, the state doesn't have to show that there is a room tossed about with furniture completely askew. However, when the complaining witness claims that in her testimony and then photographs taken shortly afterwards do not support it, yes, that causes reason to go ahead and doubt credibility. There are other witnesses who may have been able to come in and their affidavits have been attached to the record in this brief.
What would they have said?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What would the other witnesses have said?
That they would have supported the prior sexual contact, the sexual relationship. So it wouldn't even be necessary for the defendant to testify about that if for some reason the complaining witness denied, in her testimony, the prior sexual relationship. If the statement is kept out, timing, and this is something which the state doesn't seem to recognize here. The state argues in its brief that this defendant was sure to testify anyway, that he wanted to go ahead and get his consent defense out, and then that really the only way to get that consent defense out was to go ahead and testify. Now, number one, the defendant's decision to testify is a personal decision. It has to be made by the defendant. And it cannot be forced to be made in a vacuum. A defense attorney can't simply turn when it comes time for the defense case to his client and say, okay, you want to get up there and talk now or not? For that decision to be a constitutionally appropriate decision with effective assistance of counsel, that defendant has to know the ramifications, the results of what happens if he testifies, what happens if he doesn't testify. So that was completely taken away from him by defense counsel's complete missing. And when we talk about tactical decisions in this case and the trial judge's decision that this was not a tactical decision, to make a tactical decision, one has to recognize the issue in the first place and decide it's not a good idea for whatever reason to raise this issue. This was never picked up. There's no suggestion whatsoever in the record that this was ever picked up by defense counsel.
Speaking of picked up, I want to go back to another point you made about these affidavits. I don't have my appendix with me. Remind me, are you saying that a third party would have testified under oath that they had knowledge of a consensual sexual relationship between these two people?
Multiple third parties.
So the defense would have been, through the testimony of multiple third parties, that the victim, alleged victim in this case, and the defendant had an ongoing consensual sexual relationship, and what happened on this day was simply a continuation of that relationship.
Well, obviously they were not present for this last...
No, but you're saying...
That's the inference that has to be drawn, yes.
Right, well, because when I asked you my question initially, you said it's conceded there was a sexual encounter on this day, and your position is it was consensual, and you were going to call these third-party witnesses to say there was an ongoing consensual relationship, and to the extent it happened this day, there's no reason to think it wasn't consensual. Is that right?
That is correct, and actually, in the record, what occurred after the complaining witness's testimony, defense counsel failed to make a Rule 26.2 request for any prior statements of the complaining witness, simply got up there, asked the complaining witness if this ever happened before. The complaining witness then threw out there, oh, yes, that there had been a prior sexual relationship, that he'd been bothering me, or some words to that effect. Defense counsel then got the other's prior statements, and then without attempting to make any correction whatsoever in front of the jury, simply let that skunk stay in the room and said, I'm going to leave this ground alone because I don't want the trial to take too long. He said 2 weeks.
Well, why didn't the defense at the trial in this case call any of those third parties?
Because of error. The statements in the appendix were in the file of defense counsel prior to trial. So these were not newly discovered statements, newly evidence that came up after the trial. Defense counsel had these statements, so simply failed to go ahead and call this to go ahead and support that defense. But if I can get back to
Before you get back to something else, I want to be clear on this. Was the trial court, in ruling on the post-conviction motion, aware of these other statements and the fact that they would have supported a consent defense?
Yes. Yes. They, these were all submitted in the record in the trial court in the post-conviction proceeding. So, yes, the trial court was aware of that.
But I take it that was not an independent ground for finding ineffective assistance?
The trial court never reached that ground. It was an independent ground in the motion for ineffective assistance of counsel. The trial court, because it was such a clear Miranda violation, never had to reach that. There are many other grounds, unfortunately, in this case, which fortunately, I believe, the trial court didn't have to go ahead and reach, including an opening statement in which basically the trial counsel referred to the state's case as BS. Please excuse my language before this court, but that's a quote.
Who characterized it that way?
Defense counsel. Defense counsel's opening is 3 pages long. It's produced in its entirety in the appendix. Does not mention, it's defense counsel who claims that consent was what we were bringing out there throughout, doesn't mention.
All right, so let me just understand the record in this post-conviction proceeding. If I understand what everyone has told us today, at the post-conviction proceeding, it was known that this person was not a blood relative. So the defendant who was tried as if he had a relationship with a blood relative really had a relationship with a person who was not a blood relative, and I characterize it as a relationship because third parties would have testified there was a relationship and it was consensual.
Yes,
that was all known during the course of the post-conviction proceedings.
Yes, but to answer Your Honor's question to Mr. Wallace, I don't know for sure the answer to your question as to whether the case was tried as if this was a granddaughter relationship.
Well, Mr. Wallace has represented that, so I think we have to assume that.
But the incest, if we look at the docket entries, we can see that on September 13th, the day of the trial, there was a nolle prosequi entered. So for whatever reason, and I don't know whether it was because the trial was not going to be conducted that way or something was known, I don't think the incest charge went any further. And obviously the defendant was only convicted on the rape in the second degree charge.
Well, but Mr. Wallace has said incest was submitted to the jury as a possible lesser included offense.
Well, okay.
So you wouldn't have submitted it to the jury if somebody didn't think there was a factual basis. Whether you're charged is different than whether the jury was instructed that it's a possible lesser included offense.
And there may very well have been amended information filed.
So let's just stick with what everyone can agree on. Yeah. My question is, in the post-conviction proceeding, it was clear, wasn't it, that there was not a blood relationship?
Yes.
And it was also clear in the post-conviction proceeding that third parties filed affidavits about a consensual relationship.
Yes. The one on the timing issue, which I really did wanted to just add because I haven't gone ahead and made that point, and the harmless error argument, which is basically what the state is making here today as part of its argument, was raised in the trial court at the motion for post-conviction relief proceedings. Even if the defendant chose to testify, being constitutionally told, okay, if you get up there, this statement's coming into evidence, the timing then of the introduction of the statement would have been different. It wouldn't have come in the state's case. It would only have come in under Harris after the defendant actually testified to go ahead and impeach the defendant's testimony. Now, this would have allowed the defendant, if he was represented properly at the trial, to explain what the problem is. And I think the prosecutor subtly states that there were two different types of statements that the defendant made in his tape statement to the police, and we certainly don't agree that anything was voluntary. We do believe that this was in custody. But what one of those statements was an outright lie. What the defendant originally told the police officer was, no, he didn't have a sexual relationship with this young lady. He was in a granddaughter-type relationship with him. And he explained later at trial that this was out of embarrassment as to why he said it, but he did an outright lie. So under any circumstances, I don't see how it would have been not prejudicial to keep a statement, to allow a statement to come into evidence, which shows the defendant lying about the subject matter of what he's on trial for.
Well, in the affidavit that was submitted by trial counsel, it was attributed to embarrassment, and they said they dealt with that in the statements to the jury, right? Which seems logical. It wasn't truthful if we assume there was this sexual encounter, but it doesn't seem far-fetched to think that you might deny something initially out of embarrassment, then later admit it.
I would certainly agree with that, but I think any defense attorney knows the more things you have to explain to a jury, the tougher and tougher things are for that particular defendant. And that formed the basis of pretty much of the state's arguments, that the defendant lied about this, compare his testimony in trial to what he said to the police officer on the day he's being arrested. So that lie, we believe, and the statement was devastating. Now, one argument which the court started by asking about was the in custody portion, and this is an argument which I agree there was never a hearing on this below, because the state never, ever raised this issue below. And it's important, I think, for this court to understand the procedural basis of how this occurred in the Superior Court. The motion for post-conviction relief was filed, and the court reviewed the record, saw that there was a clear Miranda violation, and then directed defense counsel, trial counsel, and the state to respond. September 9th, trial counsel responded, and trial counsel didn't indicate in any way, and the entire response is contained in the appendix, never indicated that he picked up this issue, basically seemed to be saying that it was all voluntary and consensual, despite the fact that, and not even using those words, despite the fact that there was no Miranda, but really seemed to ignore the Miranda issue. September 9th, this occurs. The state then, November, doesn't file its reply to this, its answer to the defense motion for post-conviction relief, until November 25th, 2.5 months after it has trial counsel's affidavit. I've reproduced in my brief the entire state's response below. So the state has, in its brief on appeal, has reproduced the entire response on this issue below by the state. The state never, ever claimed that Mr. Jenkins was not in custody, that his freedom was not restrained. This was completely absent. They never raised this issue before the trial court. So can't be a surprise that the trial court never raised this. I then had an opportunity to file, on behalf of Mr. Jenkins, a reply. I specifically pointed out that the state's not raising an issue that there may not have been a Miranda violation for lack of custody or any other issue. In fact, I pointed out that the state specifically didn't make that argument. You can find that at pages A132 to 133 of the state's appendix, where I made that argument in the Superior Court. So I don't believe it can be any surprise whatsoever that a trial judge doesn't conduct an evidentiary hearing on an issue which no one below raised as ever being any sort of issue in this case. And now when the state lost that bite at the apple, when its harmless error argument, which was made below, was rejected at the trial court level, now it comes before this court in what we contend is a violation of this court's Rule 8 and asks this court to say, oh, we believe that he wasn't in custody and the record is clear, but even if the record is not clear, because obviously the record is not clear because no hearing was ever held on this, remand it back to Superior Court and give us another bite at the apple. Even though we had a chance to make this argument below, we chose not to make this argument below. The defense pointed out below to the trial court that they weren't making this argument below, yet the trial judge should have gone ahead and somehow figured out that he should have conducted a hearing on this issue. And remember, this is a trial judge, of course, who heard all the evidence, who had an opportunity to review and did review the actual tape and make his decision. And impliedly, by doing that, he, like the state below, was conceding that the defendant was in custody, had his freedom restrained under Miranda. The trial judge's decision in this case, we respectfully submit, was well within his discretion, was in fact correct legally and what was dictated by the law. And we respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the court had asked whether or not in the record of the post-conviction proceeding there was evidence that some witness would come forward and say, I know that there is a consensual relationship between these two people. And Mr. Gill stood here and said, yes. Please look at the exhibits that he cited in B1 through B5. Those are the two affidavits of two people, one of whom says absolutely nothing about a knowledge of any kind of relationship that was sexual between these two people, but instead is a she's a loose woman type affidavit. Says nothing about those two. Then look at the second one, the one of her cousin, I think it was, Patience Walker, at B5. This would be the testimony that Patience Walker would give. Uncle Junior she had a conversation with the victim on the day after this occurred, and the victim explained to her, when she asked, how are you, what would happen with Uncle Junior, the defendant in this case. He'd come by and wanting her to perform, I'm not going to be graphic, perform a sexual act like occurred here. She said he would give her two options, give me that sexual act or some other. If you choose not to do either, I will turn the family against you. He would, later on in her bullet points, he would pull her hair and force her head down towards his privates. More graphic testimony there. That's hardly testimony that somebody will come forward and say, I knew that they had a consensual relationship. So Mr. Liguori knew that also. He set that aside. The problem in this case, Your Honor, the state respectfully suggests is this, that the trial court didn't give deference to what Mr. Liguori knew at the time. It unfortunately somehow shifted its focus from what normally it should be, and that is, what did Mr. Liguori know at the time and what could he do? Mr. Liguori explained, I knew that Wilmer Jenkins was going to take the stand. There was no other way to raise this consensual defense. He wanted me to highlight the statement. That's in his affidavit at paragraph 5. I knew the circumstances under which he gave that statement, and I didn't believe it to be custodial. And I knew that there was no way to raise the defense without him.
Mr. Wallace,
that statement was coming in. Yes, Your Honor.
Since we're short of time, what is your response to defense argument that your contention that the defendant was not in custody at the time he gave the statement is an argument that was never raised at the trial court level?
I would have to say that it was not made in those words. It certainly was not. Unfortunately, in the proceedings, which were fairly truncated, the only way I can understand it is this. This was a Miranda issue. And in a Rule 61 proceeding, I think everyone believed that there would be a hearing on the actual facts of the Miranda issue, because there's no way not to determine whether or not somebody's in custody without having some factual finding. And we know that there are two sets of facts. There's the defense saying he was ordered to go there, and there's trial counsel saying, I didn't believe he was in custody. So it was so before the court.
Are we in plain error territory then?
I believe that that may be what the court would have to. Yes and no. I know the court doesn't like yes and no answers, but I think that's one that I have to give. For the court to determine whether or not counsel was deficient in their performance, the court would have to determine fully whether there was a Miranda violation. The state does not concede there was a Miranda violation as to the first prong, he was in custody. As to the actual warnings given, which weren't necessary, the state suggests, because he was not in custody. Yes. That's the no part. The yes part is, if the court believes that, in fact, the state absolutely had to raise that before the court, the Superior Court had to determine whether, in total, counsel would be deficient in not determining whether or not to raise a Miranda issue, then the answer is yes, plain error. Plain error says that in the interest of justice, this court can always look at that. And I suggest in this circumstance, given the nature of the proceedings, that there was no hearing, given the fact that there were those competing factual suggestions, that the interests of justice are such that this man's rape conviction against his 20-year-old granddaughter, in quotes, however you want to say it, should at very least get a hearing as to that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and we'll have a brief recess.